Chapter 100. Seeming to know that he was placed at any disadvantage, lest he should be resentful of that knowledge, and divided between her impulse towards him, and her grateful affection for Edith, she scarcely dared to raise her eyes towards either. Anxious and unhappy for them both, the thought stole on her through the crowd, that it might have been better for them, if this noise of tongues and tread of feet had never come there, if the old dullness and decay had never been replaced by novelty and splendor, if the neglected child had found no friend in Edith, but had lived her solitary life, unpitied and forgotten. Mrs. Chick had some such thoughts too, but they were not so quietly developed in her mind. This good matron had been outraged in the first instance by not receiving an invitation to dinner. That blow partially recovered, she had gone to a vast expense to make such a figure before Mrs. Dombey at home as should dazzle the senses of that lady and heap mortification, mountains high, on the head of Mrs. Skewton. "But I am made," said Mrs. Chick to Mr. Chick, "of no more account than Florence. Who takes the smallest notice of me? No one." "No one, my dear," assented Mr. Chick, who was seated by the side of Mrs. Chick against the wall, and could console himself, even there, by softly whistling. "Does it at all appear as if I was wanted here?" exclaimed Mrs. Chick, with flashing eyes. "No, my dear, I don't think it does," said Mr. Chick. "Paul's mad." said Mrs. Chick. Mr. Chick whistled. "Unless you are a monster, which I sometimes think you are," said Mrs. Chick with candor, "don't sit there humming tunes. How anyone with the most distant feelings of a man can see that mother-in-law of Paul's, dressed as she is, going on like that, with Major Bagstock, for whom, among other precious things, we are indebted to your Lucretia Tox, my dear?" said Mr. Chick, astounded. "Yes," retorted Mrs. Chick, with great severity, "your Lucretia Tox. I say how anybody can see that mother-in-law of Paul's, and that haughty wife of Paul's, and these indecent old frights with their backs and shoulders, and in short this at home generally, and on which word Mrs. Chick laid a scornful emphasis that made Mr. Chick start, "is, I thank heaven, a mystery to me." Mr. Chick screwed his mouth into a form irreconcilable with humming or whistling, and looked very contemplative. "But I hope I know what is due to myself," said Mrs. Chick, swelling with indignation, "though Paul has forgotten what is due to me. I am not going to sit here, a member of this family, to be taken no notice of. I am not the dirt under Mrs. Dombey's feet, yet not quite yet," said Mrs. Chick, as if she expected to become so, about the day after tomorrow. "And I shall go. I will not say, whatever I may think, that this affair has been got up, solely to degrade and insult me. I shall merely go. I shall not be missed." Mrs. Chick rose erect with these words, and took the arm of Mr. Chick, who escorted her from the room, after half an hour's shady sojourn there. And it is due to her penetration to observe that she certainly was not missed at all. But she was not the only indignant guest, for Mr. Dombey's list, still constantly in difficulties, were, as a body, indignant with Mrs. Dombey's list, for looking at them through eyeglasses, and audibly wondering who all those people were, while Mrs. Dombey's list complained of weariness, and the young thing with the shoulders, deprived of the attentions of that gay youth cousin Phoenix who went away from the dinner table, confidentially alleged to 30 or 40 friends that she was bored to death. All the old ladies with the burdens on their heads had greater or less cause of complaint against Mr. Dombey, and the directors and chairman coincided in thinking that if Dombey must marry, he had better have married somebody nearer his own age, not quite so handsome, and a little better off. The general opinion among this class of gentlemen was that it was a weak thing in Dombey, and he'd live to repent it. Hardly anybody there, except the mild men, stayed, or went away, without considering himself or herself neglected and aggrieved by Mr. Domney or Mrs. Domney, and the speechless female in the black velvet hat was found to have been stricken mute, because the lady in the crimson velvet had been handed down before her. The nature even of the mild men got corrupted, either from their curdling it with too much lemonade, or from the general inoculation that prevailed, and they made sarcastic jokes to one another, and whispered disparagement on stairs and in by places. The general dissatisfaction and discomfort so diffused itself, that the assembled footmen in the hall were as well acquainted with it as the company above. Nay, the very linkman outside got hold of it, and compared the party to a funeral out of mourning, with none of the company remembered in the will. At last, the guests were all gone, and the linkman too, and the street, crowded so long with carriages, was clear, and the dying lights showed no one in the rooms, but Mr. Domney and Mr. Carker, who were talking together apart, and Mrs. Domney and her mother, the former seated on an ottoman, the latter reclining in the Cleopatra attitude, awaiting the arrival of her maid. Mr. Domney having finished his communication to Carker, the latter advanced obsequiously to take leave. "I trust," apostrophe he said, "that the fatigues of this delightful evening will not inconvenience Mrs. Domney tomorrow." Apostrophe, Mrs. Domney, apostrophe said Mr. Domney, advancing, "has sufficiently spared herself fatigue to relieve you from any anxiety of that kind. I regret to say, Mrs. Domney, that I could have wished you had fatigued yourself a little more on this occasion." She looked at him with a supercilious glance, that it seemed not worth her while to protract, and turned away her eyes without speaking. "I am sorry, madam," apostrophe said Mr. Domney, "that you should not have thought it your duty." She looked at him again. "Your duty, madam," apostrophe pursued Mr. Domney, "to have received my friends with a little more deference. Some of those whom you have been pleased to slight tonight in a very marked manner, Mrs. Domney, confer a distinction upon you, I must tell you, in any visit they pay you. Do you know that there is someone here?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, she returned, now looking at him steadily. "No, Carker. I beg that you do not. I insist that you do not," apostrophe cried Mr. Domney, stopping that noiseless gentleman in his withdrawal. "Mr. Carker, madam, as you know, possesses my confidence. He is as well acquainted as myself with the subject on which I speak. I beg to tell you, for your information, Mrs. Domney, that I consider these wealthy and important persons confer a distinction upon me." And Mr. Domney drew himself up, as having now rendered them of the highest possible importance. "I ask you," apostrophe she repeated, bending her disdainful, steady gaze upon him, "do you know that there is someone here, sir?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, I must entreat," apostrophe said Mr. Carker, stepping forward, "I must beg, I must demand, to be released. Slight and unimportant as this difference is," apostrophe, Mrs. Skewton, who had been intent upon her daughter's face, took him up here. "My sweetest Edith," apostrophe she said, "and my dearest Domney, our excellent friend Mr. Carker, for so I am sure I ought to mention him," apostrophe, Mr. Carker murmured, "too much honor," apostrophe, apostrophe has used the very words, "that were in my mind, and that I have been dying, these ages, for an opportunity of introducing. Slight and unimportant. My sweetest Edith, and my dearest Domney, do we not know that any difference between you two? No, Flowers, not now." Flowers was the maid, who, finding gentlemen present, retreated with precipitation. "That any difference between you two," apostrophe resumed Mrs. Skewton, "with the heart you possess in common, and the excessively charming bond of feeling that there is between you, must be slight and unimportant? What words could better define the fact? None. Therefore I am glad to take this slight occasion, this trifling occasion, that is so replete with nature and your individual characters, and all that so truly calculated to bring the tears into a parent's eyes to say that I attach no importance to them in the least, except as developing these minor elements of soul, and that, unlike most mamas-in-law, that odious phrase, dear Dommy, as they have been represented to me to exist in this, I fear, to artificial world, I never shall attempt to interpose between you, at such a time, and never can much regret, after all, such little flashes of the torch, of what's his name, not Cupid, but the other delightful creature. There was a sharpness in the good mother's glance at both her children as she spoke, that may have been expressive of a direct and well-considered purpose hidden between these rambling words. That purpose, providently to detach herself in the beginning from all the clankings of their chain that were to come, and to shelter herself with the fiction of her innocent belief in their mutual affection and their adaptation to each other. I have pointed out to Mrs. Dommy, apostrophe said Mr. Dommy, in his most stately manner, that in her conduct thus early in our married life, to which I object, and which, I request, may be corrected. Carker, apostrophe with a nod of dismissal, good night to you. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Carker bowed to the imperious form of the bride, whose sparkling eye was fixed upon her husband, and stopping at Cleopatra's couch on his way out, raised to his lips the hand she graciously extended to him, in lowly and admiring homage. If his handsome wife had reproached him, or even changed countenance, or broken the silence in which he remained, by one word, now that they were alone, for Cleopatra made off with all speed, Mr. Dommy would have been equal to some assertion of his case against her. But the intense, unutterable, withering scorn, with which, after looking upon him, she dropped her eyes, as if he were too worthless, and indifferent to her to be challenged with a syllable, the ineffable disdain and haughtiness in which she sat before him, the cold inflexible resolve with which her every feature seemed to bear him down, and put him by these, he had no resource against, and he left her, with her whole overbearing beauty concentrated on despising him. Was he coward enough to watch her, an hour afterwards, on the old well staircase, where he had once seen Florence in the moonlight, toiling up with Paul? Or was he in the dark by accident, when, looking up, he saw her coming, with a light, from the room where Florence lay, and marked again the face so changed, which he could not subdue? But it could never alter as his own did. It never, in its uttermost pride and passion, knew the shadow that had fallen on his, in the dark corner, on the night of the return, and often since, and which deepened on it now, as he looked up. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.